My guest today is Stephanie Kirkpatrick. She is the CEO of Orum. Website is orum.io. The company has raised $85 million to date, and they are primarily focused on providing API infrastructure to help businesses, financial businesses, move money faster. They are using the RTP, or the Real-Time Payments Network, to do this. We talked about the ACH system. We talked about RTP. We talked about FedNow, Zelle, wire transfers. These are different payment settlement layers. And we went into detail about the differences of how they work, who owns them, how they were created, and the downsides of these new settlement layers. We discussed Orum, where they're going, where they came from, how Stephanie started the company working in a larger fintech company and then hiring an Indian development firm in the early days. Now they're far beyond that. We talked about the current financial and banking crisis that we're in the midst of now, recording March 28th, 2023. We discussed the impact that crypto has on this crisis and where we're all going, how the consolidation of banking looks in the future, and speculated on what the implications of that will be. Hope you enjoy this conversation. Stephanie is incredibly knowledgeable in her experience, both in running Orum, but also just more broadly in how the banking system, the financial system works. And lastly, we touched on financial advisors. She was one in the past, and so we discussed what makes a great financial advisor, what to look for. And if you have any feedback, thoughts, suggestions for new guests, please send them in. Otherwise, any thumbs up or sharing of this podcast is greatly appreciated. Without further ado, here is Stephanie Kirkpatrick. All right, Stephanie, thanks for jumping on today. I'm excited to get to know you more, get to know what you're working on. Why don't we kick it off there? You guys at Orum have raised a bunch of money, seem to be doing some really great things. Tell me just briefly why you started the company and what you guys are trying to do in the world.
My story starts back in Portland, Oregon, which is where you happen to be these days. So when I kind of think about the childhood I had, the influence that I had growing up in a household where my dad was an immigrant, came to the U.S. with literally nothing. So much of my life has been shaped by the desire to spend time helping others who have less have more. And at Orum, we are the simplest API integration for instant payouts, which means that we can start working on and help people solve the time to money problem, right? And it, in my mind, is one of the most critical aspects of the way we think about the American wallet, the way small businesses operate, even the way the global supply chain is impacted by the ability to actually speed up the way money moves in a 24/7, 365 format. And so when I think about all the things that are important to me as a founder and also as a certified financial planner, which is what I was doing before I was in tech, I think about the opportunity to have reach and magnitude of reach and impact through what we're building. And so as a CFP, you can reach potentially hundreds of people. But through technology, you have the opportunity to go beyond that from thousands to millions to hundreds of millions. And at Orum, as we are building the most unique payment stack in the industry, specifically around instant payouts, you can integrate with us in 2 days or less, and you can build a full payment stack there quickly. No prolonged compliance, no major overhead to go direct to a bank. We do all of that for you. And then you can help customers build incredibly new, rich products, a lot of which drive both new customer acquisition and ultimately different forms of revenue. And then we're in a position to grow with our customers and help them figure out what are they going to be working on next in service of how to continuously embed instant and faster and better payment into the ecosystem of what they're building. So I think most of what we do at Orum centers on this idea that if you could speed up the way people access their money, then you wouldn't have to spend time thinking about the complexities of payment orchestration. You could solve a wholly different set of problems. And that is what I think ultimately is the unlock of spending time in this part of the market going to be as I look ahead to the next decade, which is probably the journey that we're on as a company in order to really make tremendous amounts of impact.
So how did you make that career transition? I mean, you're now running this company and you were doing financial planning.
Yes.
What happened?
I think I'm not the traditional founder in a lot of ways, but I think a lot of it was just driven by curiosity, which is a core value that I have personally and that we have at the company. That one day, literally out of the blue, a little CD-ROM product, which tells you about how old I am, for the first job I had stopped coming. And it sort of blew up this company. Like, you know, I can remember walking around the office and everyone's like, what are we going to do without the software we're so used to having? And I basically raised my hand and said, well, listen, as a financial planner, the math behind this software is pretty simple. I learned how to do it on my fancy calculator. So why don't we just build an app that could do the math in a way that's really consumable? And that was the beginning of what became my interest and passion for building through technology better solutions. So at the time, I had no idea what I was signing up for. I went to a platform at the time that is now Upwork and then called Elance, and basically just found an American who was building a development shop in India and wrote him a note and said, here's what I'm trying to solve. And he goes, you're going to have to send me some wireframes. And I was like quickly Googling, what are wireframes, right? Like it was just from a financial planning background, like so not in my DNA to know how to think about technology. But it came quickly, this idea that you could build better experiences. That was the first part, right? Build a better experience. That ended up getting sold into a bank. And then I came to what I'm going to call a more official startup called LearnVest, where I had the opportunity to really double click on the 0-to-1 experience of being in tech. And we sold that company to Northwestern Mutual back in 2015. And at Northwestern Mutual, all of a sudden you see inside big financial services, the time to money problem. Money in, out, and across financial services platforms is slow. The system that we're built on, ECH, was built 50 years ago. And just like any other part of outdated infrastructure, roads, bridges, whatever it may be, this infrastructure wasn't designed for what we're doing today. It wasn't designed to contemplate the way people engage digitally with their money. It wasn't designed to contemplate urgency and speed of accessing money. And it wasn't designed to contemplate fast-moving fraud schemes that are ever more complex as a result of how AI has changed and the way that the fraudsters are working. And so it deepened my curiosity to continue to build and work in a space that was going to be high impact and that was ultimately going to be solving a problem that I think from my childhood into my early career and all the way through my tech years has just been important to me and remains top of mind. And I think it's why ultimately a lot of folks do come to Aurum with a conviction because they themselves have seen something in their life where time to money, right? Getting paid, getting an insurance claim paid out, and having access to money that's in a brokerage account that you need back on a Sunday, all of those things and more end up being really clear pain points that draw in folks who really want to work on solving this problem and frankly, rebuild the infrastructure that financial services is built on in the first place.
Yes. Okay. So I want to make sure I get where you were psychologically at LearnVest. So you're working, your company was acquired by LearnVest. You're in this large business and you say, I want to work with this Indian development shop and build out a new product because this large financial company and many others like it can't figure out how to get paid faster. Was there a particular technological insight that you saw? Because on a superficial level, moving money faster is a very obvious problem that is front and center for many.
Is it an obvious problem?
I think so. I think that when it comes to moving money, I think people want it guaranteed to go where they want it to go. So if I send someone a bank transfer, it has to go to their bank account. And the only other attribute of that payment, well, there's two, right? There would be speed and cost. So I can send a wire transfer.
Risk?
I think a risk is the first one. Risk is it has to go to where I want it to go. It has to be cheap and it has to be fast. So companies that I talk to, and I've talked to a bunch of them, they tend to be focused on one of those three, like cheaper, faster, better. So fast is definitely an appeal. But where were you when you were at this company and you said, I want to focus on speed? And did you see something? I mean, did you see like, okay, if we stack ACH transfers, we could front load them and then credit people's accounts faster? Like what was the insight that made this possible technically?
The first insight was actually watching people get access to financial advice, because financial advice guides you to do something with your money, right? Don't just sit idle, put it somewhere, put it somewhere better. And some of those places that could be better than sitting idle, especially in today's market, would be like a high yield savings, but maybe it's not at the bank you bank with. So you have to move it somewhere else. And when you want it back, it's going to take 3, 4, maybe even 5 days, depending on whether or not it's a night, a holiday, a weekend, when you go to initiate that bank transfer. You put it in a brokerage account, into a crypto wallet, places where it could grow exponentially, potentially, but you need it back. And so the kind of mindset that people carry is, well, I'd rather not put it in these better or optimal places, because what if I have an emergency? What if on Saturday, when the banking system is closed and ACH and wires aren't operating, I need access to my money? What if? And so it leaves people in a position of essentially fear, even though they know that the math says, hey, this is a better path. So the first insight is really from a financial planning perspective, seeing how people behave. It's not like they don't know where they could put money, even if it's small dollars, right? It doesn't have to be wealthy, high net worth, right? What we were working on at LearnVest initially was for the 99%. It's about that insight that says, what holds people back? Well, they can't get it back at night or on the weekends. Why? Then you start to unpack what's going on with the ACH system and why is it only operational 9 to 5? Why doesn't it work on Saturday? Why is the best innovation to access my own money the ATM? Why hasn't anything else happened since then that actually speeds up money movement? And so it's interesting hearing you say, oh, wow, it's an obvious problem. Speed is an obvious problem, but it hasn't been until very recently a very big topic of conversation. Banks were designed to manage risk and they were designed to operate only during certain constrained hours. And that worked until it did. And so my insight, my aha, was watching people choose not to do something that could build wealth, could build safety nets, could build stability, could grow their dollar. Because the system underpinning how their money would go from point A to point B didn't serve the needs of the actual use case of it's my money. I need it to be accessed wherever, whenever, however I need to access it. So that's what I need to think a bit more about, like, what's going on with the infrastructure? Is it even possible to change it? And yeah, the answer is it is possible, right? And today, with real-time payments, RTP, the network that the Clearinghouse runs, and FedNow, which we're excited to be partners with the Fed to launch later this year, you have now two new ways to move money, faster, better, smarter, instantly. The challenge isn't that they exist. The challenge is that you have to be able to optimize using them where they are able to deliver that instant experience. And so what used to be a simple framework, to your point, if you needed to go fast, pay a high fee for wires. If you wanted to go slow, 5 days a week, you can use ACH. Well, now the complexity of the options is greater. So what we do is a little bit like what Amazon does for same-day delivery. In the bank transfer world, you could do an ACH, a same-day ACH, an RTP, a wire. That's all under our unified API. And we orchestrate how it goes from point A to point B. With Amazon, you order a package. You don't pick FedEx for the delivery option, right? You just pick the window in which you want it delivered. Amazon is the one actually optimizing, should it go the postal service, UPS, all the varieties of ways that it can get to you. And that's how I would think about bank transfers, is that in an effort to speed them up and to manage for the three key pillars of speed, risk, and cost, the configuration and orchestration actually becomes really critical. So it's one, it's about accessing new and modern ways in the infrastructure space to move money. And two, it's piecing together the complexity of the decisions that go with that money movement so that when you or anybody else, consumer or business, is thinking about money movement, the certainty that it's going to the right place, the conviction that it will get there on time, whatever time that may be, and the optionality to have choices on what you pay so that you could do something instant that doesn't cost $50, which is what a wire often costs, opens up a whole new set of opportunities for how people build products in and around and adjacent to payments and financial services.
Gotcha. Okay. So it sounds like the insight that you had technically was that the Fed launched RTP, real-time payments. And was that kind of, you're like, hey, this new system is coming out that'll make it possible to send money faster. Let's go build a company around that. Was that like long and short of it?
That was part of it. I mean, that was certainly part of it. That's part of the inspiration for saying, let's design a system that feels like same-day delivery for Amazon, but contemplates money movement. Because when you introduce new systems, the Clearinghouse and its real-time payment solution, the Fed, and its faster payments product called FedNow, you have so many more ways of doing it than you did before. And they don't all cover the same territories or the same banks. They operate slightly differently. So there was definitely inspiration in saying, hey, this new thing is out there, but it's being really underutilized, right? So the last few years, almost nobody was talking about real-time payments. And now every day, that's a topic of conversation. And it's frankly why our pipeline of customers is at an all-time high, because the demand to do something instantly has grown tremendously in the last few years. The capability to use it has been around, but the interest in leveraging faster payment systems has really been something that I think we've seen more and more of in the last really 3 years, as I think more and more folks have turned to digital solutions and have really thought about, hey, in the other part of my life, I can get everything instantly. Why with my own money can I not get access to dollars to move them, to trade them, to exchange them, to receive something from a business, right? There's so many use cases there. And so the inspiration is is long-term thinking in saying, like, there's a revolution happening. How do we propel that revolution faster to get better adoption so that when companies are building products, they aren't asking the question on speed of money movement. They're focused on actually building value around all the other things that sit in front of getting the funds moved from point A to point B.
When was this RTP system launched, do you know? And is it managed centrally? Like, does the federal government manage this thing? And like, I'm just curious.
It was
curious,
designed?
Yeah, go ahead.
It was designed over a series of years. The RTP network is owned by the Clearinghouse, which means it's owned by about the top 20 banks. So it was designed to super serve large banks on the retail side or on the business side. And it was launched in 2019. And it was expected to be groundbreaking adoption. But it ultimately only had a handful of banks that were on it using the network initially. And so like anything, think back to Apple Pay, right? Early days Apple Pay, how many times could you double tap and just pay? Not that often. So you whipped out your phone or your watch here and there. Now, literally almost everywhere, Apple Pay is fully ubiquitous. And so the banks that own the clearinghouse had an adoption challenge, which is not that the idea isn't innovative and interesting, but as a bank who operates 9 to 5 on a batch-based system tied into a deep technology called a core, how do I possibly become a real-time bank? How does every bank, how do 11,000 financial institutions in the U.S. go from 9 to 5 Monday through Friday to 24/7, 365? The technology, the people, the operations, that's a lot of work. And so initially, banks were slow to adopt use of RTP. And now we're at a kind of tipping point where there is about 300 banks on the RTP network, which doesn't sound like a lot when you think about the fact that there are 5,000 banks, 11,500 financial institutions. But from a 0 to 1 perspective, it's a lot because it covers about 70-75% of consumer bank accounts. And so 75% of the time, you could make a transfer instant. I'll take it at the starting point.
Yeah.
And every month, every quarter, every day that we work on this problem, the awareness rises, the demand from consumers and businesses rises, and the technology layers that companies like Aurum are building are further enabling simplicity of accessing the networks in a way that previously wasn't a capability in the market. And so I think all three of those things are powerful push to an inflection point where instant becomes the norm.
And is the RTP, FedNow, ACH, Wire, is Zelle another payment network? I know that they...
Absolutely.
Yes. Is that like, are those the five major ones? I mean, do you think about this from like a systems perspective where there's like mm-hmm. the ACH system, the Wire mm-hmm. system, RTP mm-hmm. system, FedNow system? Like, do banks need intermediary technology companies to be able to utilize these systems? Like that's your strategy, or how does get rolled out? Because in the case of Zelle, I think they were similar to your example here. They were owned collectively by a bunch of large banks, and they integrate them right into the app, and they have a third party design and build it, but they own the IP. So they have kind of incentive to adopt it. And then it's mm-hmm. better, right? It's better for their customers because it's faster and easier to use than sending ACH or Wire. Is that like, how does RTP and FedNow position relative to Zelle and, yeah, really just Zelle?
So Zelle's network effect has been really interesting to watch, right? Because to your point, it is also owned by a consortium of banks. P.S., it's the same banks that own the clearinghouse, that own RTP. The systems were really designed for fundamentally different purposes. In a peer-to-peer transaction, I'm paying you. The back-and-forth exchange of funds is pretty straightforward, and it's very specific to interbank transfers that don't go above a certain size, let's say. So much like Venmo, where maybe I'm paying you back for a birthday party or trip or a brunch together, you know, small dollar frequent transactions versus being able to transact, let's say, up to $1 million in real time, which is what the RTP network does. So they're fundamentally different. They have different messaging standards, different settlement standards, which is, again, why I think the complexity and where Aurum sits in the market is to orchestrate payments across all these different kinds of solutions is really powerful. Zelle is cool because it takes your name or your phone number or your email and it identifies you. You don't actually have to have your account and routing number. It ties to a directory in the back end that looks up the right bank information so that Stephanie's email address can be correlated to a bank account, thus an seemingly instant transaction can occur. Now, there are downsides to that, which is my email and my bank account have a one-to-one relationship. But it is a very powerful thing to be able to say, wow, I don't have to go find my account routing number. I don't need an aggregator like Plaid or MX or Finicity or anything else. I can just use something I commonly use every day. That, I think, is really powerful in the world of payments because it's like, what's in my head? What do I automatically know? So I can provide information to receive or send a payment. So Zelle has actually been super interesting to watch because it did create a pretty big groundswell of adoption. And the use cases grew from peer-to-peer to include more B2B. So the network itself has grown tremendously since launch. It is distinct from RTP, and RTP is distinct from FedNow. Those are on new settlement frameworks that require, again, being able to manage money movement in real time. What happens at 2 a.m. on a Tuesday night when the banking operations center and the fraud and compliance teams are not working at a bank traditionally? How do you then bring a technology like that into a financial institution? Partners like Orem can do it really seamlessly because we help bring the entire structure of how to keep track, which is what we call a ledger, how to identify risk in the system, how to block bad actors, speed up more good actors, and ultimately how to manage operations if something does go wrong in the middle of the night, on the weekends, on a holiday. So it's an operating model that's really interesting in part because it's leveraging something that is available to everyone, which is just time, right? But banks themselves, as providers of faster payment services, don't all have the resources to overhaul their systems, overhaul their operations. So partnering with technology providers is a great way to advance the agenda of faster payments and beyond what is maybe possible without technology that can streamline and simplify it.
And how long and how much does it take to, you're selling to banks, right? So you're pitching them on, is this a 12-month sales cycle that costs them some resources on the engineering side and like, I imagine risk and legal assessment, all this stuff. And then they say, okay, go ahead, Stephanie, let's launch Orem. Like, what do you have to do to be successful selling into a bank, technically speaking?
Well, to be successful in payments, technically speaking, you have to make sure that 100% of the time, the payment goes from point A to point B exactly as planned. So that's our first kind of highest order priority. We think of our customers really as sort of more industry specific, right? So banks are certainly potential partners for us. But what I get really excited about is unlocking access to all these complex and frankly, very powerful forms of money movement for people who are not banks. Because people who are building innovative technology, not exclusively in fintech, but across the tech ecosystem, they're the ones who most need the ability to do something better, smarter, faster. And frankly, they're the ones that aren't going to have the $75 million budget to invest in some sort of technology upgrade, right? So the fact that we are turnkey, a single API that unifies all of those transfers, that orchestrates all of those payments, you can integrate to us in literally 2 days. So our payment stack is simple, straightforward. Our APIs are easy to use. That is a force multiplier because you can get many companies who want to operate in financial services but are not banks to have the superpower of instant payments, which can drive them further faster because, to your point, the cost and overhead of lots of engineers focused on all the payments backend doesn't have to be true. So the plug-and-play nature of what we do ends up being a real amplification for companies who know that payments are going to be important to their strategy, but their actual business model isn't to be a payments company or even to be a bank. And so things like the factoring industries and things like creator economy, things like earned and early wage access are really interesting places where there's a ton of development. How people get paid, how they pay, all of that sits at the intersection of why we like solving the time to money problem, right? And the time to money could be 15 seconds when you're using something like RTP versus 5 days on ACH. Those are the kinds of force multipliers that I get really excited about when we can work with somebody who's building net new products and services that touch payments are definitely adjacent to, but are wholly innovative solutions in their own right. Trucking, logistics. I mean, I could go on and on about the industries and use cases where instant becomes really powerful.
So I'm going to just take a guess and you correct me where I'm wrong. So this is what's technically happening. You have an API where a company will integrate your API into their tech stack. And then it will make an API call to the host, the bank of the person who the company is utilizing, like an employee or a contractor of that bank, and will say, send a RTP payment to this other bank account. And so your API gets two bank accounts details, and then it sends a request to the RTP network and says, make this transaction. And then RTP comes back and says, status good. And then money is moved on the RTP side. Is that basically how it's technically working, or how would you modify?
That's a very simple, straightforward way to understand it. And I think you touched on something really important, which is RTP immediately sends back the signal, good, not good, bad, right? And it can identify, because that's a messaging layer, what's actually going on. Whereas on ACH, it's a manual process 3 days after the transfer to send back any information about why that transfer maybe wasn't a good transfer. Bad actor, bad account, not enough money, right? There are many reasons why. And so knowing instantly, did it go through or not, and what happened, is also important because of all of the additional overhead and fraud vectors that can be inserted when there's a time lapse between the request to transfer money and the actual settlement window. And the longer that is, which on ACH is typically a minimum of 3 days, the worse the scenario is for everybody involved in the transaction. And it's why in the consumer mind, we like credit cards, right? I swipe. I walk into Starbucks, I swipe. Starbucks knows instantly at point of sale, am I good for the money or not? Starbucks actually doesn't get the money when I swipe my card. It all settles on bank rails later. But they have the certainty in that moment that they're not going to be defrauded and that that transaction is a valid transaction and that I, Stephanie, have funds for it. Think of RTP as similar, which is, it can't be used today to check out at Starbucks. It can be used to send money out of an insurance account to pay a claim. It can be sent from a brokerage or crypto account back into your checking or savings. In all of those instances, the certainty that it got there, which is, again, our number one priority, a transfer goes from point A to point B on time with certainty. That is why RTP, one of the reasons why RTP is so powerful, right? The message and the timeline that it operates on are fundamentally new and different.
Interesting. And the ACH system is old. You mentioned it's manual. I'm assuming people are not literally doing any human.
I wouldn't be so quick to assume that there's no human. In fact, there's large teams that work in banks whose job it is to run through and review transactions, look for anomalies, communicate information back and forth. A lot of the work is manual. It's a file. Yeah. ACH is a flat file. Right? Wow. It is a flat file of information sent at certain intervals throughout the day. And you could open up and send the intervals on the weekends, I suppose, but that doesn't change that it's manual and that it doesn't settle instantly and that it doesn't carry data alongside the transaction. And so there's a bunch of, again, system designs that you would do differently today, which is why RTP and Fed now have so many more of these modern contemporary frameworks than 50 years ago when people weren't sitting on their phones, yet to be invented, and doing digital account opening, yet to be invented, to have a neobank, yet to be invented, to move money, right? Yeah. So many things have changed. And yet the one thing that underpins all of that money movement, $75 trillion of money movement, was built 50 years ago and literally not changed since. And so that is one of the reasons why this is such a moment in time.
Yeah. And so RTP, invented by or created by, funded at least by a lot of large banks. The FedNow program, is the intention to supersede the ACH system? So the ACH will just stop working and then the FedNow will be the predominant settlement layer underneath all U.S. domestic regulated bank transfers. Is that the general direction?
The easiest analogy to draw is FedEx and UPS. They both cover every zip code in the U.S. these days. When they started, they did not. One, I think, would deem themselves more a ground carrier, right? UPS was really in the ground business and FedEx is really in the air freight business. Now, they ultimately cross over in some areas, but they do specialize. And one is typically a little more expensive, FedEx, because it's usually for high value goods. I'm going to FedEx you legal documents, right? High value. Versus UPS, I'm going to ship a large piece of furniture. Maybe it's high value, but it can take a longer ride to get from point A to point B. That's how I would think about FedNow and RTP. They're fundamentally different. Will they eventually create ubiquity that you could get to every bank account in every part of the country? I hope so, because that's when we win with faster payments. And some are designed more exclusively for larger banks. I would say that RTP has been predominantly leveraged by larger banks. And the Fed's FedNow product will not serve large banks, but it is also designed to better serve smaller banks who don't have the same technology advantage that the bigger banks had in designing their own system in the first place. And so I think they're really interesting because if done right, much like FedEx and UPS, which started as very different things and ultimately coexist very, I think, seamlessly and are required for different reasons to both exist, we're going to see both of these systems mature a lot in the next few years.
I've heard quite a bit of critical perspectives on FedNow. By analogy, the CBDC, like a central bank digital currency, while it's not released or I don't think has any plans to be released in the U.S., the FedNow program has this kind of centralized power to it, right? The federal government, the Federal Reserve, I believe, has direct oversight into everybody's banks. And with that power comes greater speed and efficiency. You can move money back and forth, but you could also, in theory, just take money out of people's account or just shut people's account down directly. Do you agree with that criticism? Does it make sense? Do you see it differently? Or is it just something to be aware of in that it is a greater centralization of power? And with that, we get upsides, like it's faster and more efficient, but that we just need to be more aware of that centralization of power. Does that resonate with you?
I mean, I think that the question you're asking is probably less for me to answer and more like a non-starter for a lot of different kinds of conversation. I think the way I think about it is that in the places where central banks have been critical to the strategy for faster payments, India and UPI, and specifically and more recently, Brazil and the PIX system, you've seen widespread adoption with little downside and modernizing. So by virtue of the name, a central bank is designed to govern the central and dominant form of banking infrastructure in a country. In the U.S., I think we have historically and currently believed that that is good for us. And I don't have any reason to believe that that's not good for us. That doesn't counter what happens in DeFi, the fact that there are lots of, I think, really interesting protocols being created that probably won't replace central bank technology, but could make some aspects of what we do today with paper dollars into digital dollars be really intriguing. I think we're a long ways out from having a real sense of how, whether it's governed by the central bank or not, digital currency is going to unfold beyond what we've talked about in terms of the instant frameworks available today, right? Crypto's a bit of an unknown as to whether or not it will be regulated as an asset class, if it will become kind of considered a currency, if a little bit of both, depending on where you look. And so I think time will tell a little bit more about what's going to happen there, but ultimately central bank support for faster payments is important. And I think from the perspective of where the Fed and the FedNow products sit, it's a good push in the US for us to get further faster.
So you just tell me your reaction to this. These are some thoughts running through my head in no particular order. But I think the recent Silicon Valley Bank collapse is has exposed the massive amount of debts that banks carry. And smaller banks, more regional banks, tend to carry a lot more commercial real estate debt, and that debt is going to start to affect the banks more seriously when commercial real estate leases come up for renewal and companies opt out. That's been recognized, and I think we are seeing a mass... So that's one piece of it. You have distribution of debt, Silicon Valley exposing that the banks have... The number I saw was about $700 billion of debt because they bought treasuries when the interest rates were very low. They bought long-term treasuries. So the Fed has said a few weeks ago that they will backstop or provide unlimited deposit insurance from the FDIC for, what do they call it, systemically important banks. And apparently Silicon Valley being roughly number 20th largest bank, is like significant enough. But you mentioned there's 5,000 banks. If I'm number 4,000 and I have 500,000 in this account, I'm moving out immediately. So we're seeing today a mass exodus from people out of those smaller banks into the larger banks because those large banks are going to be backed by the government where the smaller banks wouldn't be. And so that makes perfect sense. I would imagine we're going to see, as that consolidation happens, greater centralized control of the banking system and probably a decrease in the number of total banks that exist. So maybe in 5 years, instead of 5,000 banks, maybe there's, I don't know, 10% of that, like 5% of that. It seems like it's going to dramatically shrink or dramatically get more consolidated. At the same time, we also have a undeniable effort by the government to stop crypto, to at least put a serious wrench. Coinbase, Binance, you name it, every large crypto company is basically being attacked at the same time from different angles. And at the same time, the Fed is like, oh, it's cool. We're in a good spot. Nothing to worry about. Meanwhile, like Credit Suisse, Switzerland's largest bank, basically went defunct. They were acquired for pennies on the dollar. There seems to be a real anxiety witnessing the banking crisis that we're in the midst of, the centralization of power. And at the same time, FedNow launches in July, which combined with very strong centralization in the banking industry. And if you were to kill crypto and you have massive debts, you're effectively creating a really strong centralization of power in the finance, in the banking industry. And these would you call them vectors almost? They're like happening at the same time, give people a lot of cause for concern. And there's some people saying, get out, move into Bitcoin now while you still can before they shut down the rails and burn the bridges. Other people are saying, it's fine, it's no big deal, back to business as usual. But when you look at some of the charts in the debt, it's difficult to see it as just being fine. I don't personally see the smaller banks going bankrupt or going on runs because the Fed has provided these swap loans, which is basically money that they're giving to banks in exchange for the debt that they hold on their long-term treasuries. So it's a little bit of a band-aid, but it seems like it's just a band-aid on top of a band-aid on top of a band-aid. Like, we printed a ton of money when we had the pandemic. People stopped working, so we were unproductive as a society, really a global society, for the better part of a year. And it seems like we have to pay for that somehow. I don't know where all that points to, but it doesn't seem to me like it points to just business as usual. Like, we're just going to be in the same spot 2 years, 3 years, 4 years from now. Again, I don't know what, I'm not projecting anything specific, but it does feel like a very unusually unpredictable time, and especially relevant in the banking sector, and especially relevant in what we're talking about, which is like, mm-hmm. What are the rails on which money moves and who controls those rails? We saw in Canada, the government just stopped the bank accounts of the truck drivers who were protesting. Whether you agree with them or not, I have a concern at a minimum with the government's ability to intervene. And the Federal Reserve, last thing I'll say, and then you tell me your reaction. But the Federal Reserve was designed to be separate from the federal power. So to have the central bank and the federal government intertwined in one, we recognize as a society that's a real cause for concern. So the design was separate it, have the Federal Reserve be separate from the government, and that prevents abusing the monetary policy for your own presidential or federal political incentives. So I know I threw a lot at you. Pick and choose what you think is most interesting. But that's sort of what's on the top of my mind, and I wanted to just throw at you.
Well, I think that there was a lot in there, so I'm digesting. But I think that if a few years from now things didn't look different, I'd be disappointed. I'd be surprised. How different, why they're different, I can't really predict that. And that's been an evolving state, actually for quite a while within banking, whether it's visible or not. What I do think is important, and this is a personal perspective, I'm not a banker, but I actually think that the reason why we have 5,000 banks and why I think we want to keep regional and community banks is because they serve a really distinct purpose. As much as we've been excited by the advances in, let's say, underwriting online to get a loan, opening an account digitally for the underbank, which are absolutely advancements. When you're a farmer in a small town and you're going to need financing for something on your farm, you walk into a bank branch and you talk to another person. And the way your loan is underwritten is backstopped by who you are in the community, what's going on locally. And that is going to be recreated with algorithms, at least not in the short term. And maybe it will look different 2 years from now than how I'm describing it now. But the criticality of a community bank and regional bank system is super important. And I think the average depositor, business, or consumer trusts their bank. And the reason that you get runs on banks is because trust erodes, sometimes for the right reasons, sometimes not for the right reasons. Banks fail all the time. They don't always make the news. The bank that acquired Silicon Valley Bank has acquired a number of other banks out of receivership, didn't ever make the news, at least not where we live locally in New York or Portland. Why is that? I think it's because it's an assumed and expected part of a system, which is that small banks sometimes don't have the resources to continue to grow or to operate at a level of what's required. And so they fold into other banks. That's been true for decades. I don't think that is probably going to change, but I do think changes, which is actually wasn't something that you talked about, but is top of mind for me, is how does the FDIC, how do the other regulatory bodies that touch banking or banking infrastructure think about the speed of a run on a bank in an era when you can move $40 billion out of one bank in one day?
Crazy.
And you compare that to what's happened historically, that's never been done. The biggest run on a bank was not nearly the same size and scale, and it didn't happen in one day. It happened in 10, if you look back at WaMu. So I think those are really interesting questions, which isn't how do we not have central banking infrastructure, but importantly, how do we have an understanding of the stress tests that banks might need to go through for evolving situations that perhaps weren't contemplated, but now we can see clearly with hindsight are an important part of that decision framework. And I think every bank, it's sort of optimal way to make money is to take deposits and then to lend them out. And in the case that they are giving depositors an interest rate, they have to make up the max somewhere. And so in a high interest rates environment, sometimes that's easier than in a low interest rate environment. Where do they park their cash, if not in loans, to be able to create a return that people will keep money in that bank? So it's kind of a formulaic thing that happens in every bank, big and small, which is just lending is critical to deposits are just a gateway to actually how the bank makes money. And whenever it's net interest margin is misaligned, they have to pay the depositor more money for interest to keep funds at the bank than they are earning on their loan. The math looks bad. And I think that's ultimately kind of what underpinned the immediacy of the crisis at Silicon Valley Bank. Probably resolvable had the fear not set in. It kicked in pretty quickly and, to my point, kind of triggered rapid outflows. So there are probably lots of things that we'll look back on, even in a year, and say, wow, these are the learnings that have changed the way regulators and others in the banking ecosystem operate things. But I think we're a long way from saying that we're not going to have thousands of different shapes and sizes of banks that super serve a variety of different use cases. That doesn't mean that our neobanks are going away, but it does mean, I think, that our regional and community banks are going to continue to have protection so that they can exist because they serve a very special need in the market. So opinion of one, not a banker.
When you say continue to have protection, does that mean you think FDIC will raise the 250K limit for smaller banks?
I'm not sure if they'll raise the limit, but I think that it's a part of various regulatory frameworks that have been created over time. Looking back to Dodd-Frank and the Durbin Amendment, small community banks have been given specific carve-outs in how they can charge interchange and other things, which has made them a great home base to run programs for fintechs. And I think that's a little known fact as to why they were protected against the big guys and why we wanted them to continue to exist. So I think if possible that the insurance limit could increase. Increasing those insurance limits increases how much every bank has to contribute to the insurance fund that runs behind FDIC. So I don't know. They did increase it over time and it's not unheard of that it could change again. But I'm not sure that is the actual protection that's needed to keep small banks alive.
I just don't see how regional banks survive. Two primary stresses seem to be just crushing them. One is if you're a depositor in a small bank, get out now is the message. And everyone has. I mean, a vast majority of people that have over 250K, everyone, right, would get out of those small banks because they're not insured, right? If the bank goes under and you know the bank is in debt and all you're just waiting for is the bank run, which could happen any hour, get out. So everyone starts consolidating in big banks. Meanwhile, those smaller banks carry a tremendous amount of debt from the treasuries they purchased. And at the same time, they have a disproportionately high percentage of their portfolio in commercial real estate debt, which is going to be I know I don't see like the office sector coming back roaring after the pandemic. And so I'm like, where is the equity value? Like these things are like, they're just shells of organizations. There's no equity there.
How many depositors have more than $250,000 or a 500 joint basis?
I don't think it needs to
be a
lot.
Most Americans don't have $300. Most American households don't have $300 for an emergency. So I think that we should just be eyes wide open that the majority of bank customers aren't high net worth and ultimately potentially don't ever exceed that $250,000.
I think that's the.
So I'm not sure.
Well, I think you're asking the way you framed it was how many customers. I think it's what percentage of total deposits would be the question that would impact the banks the most. So maybe it's less than 1% of deposit accounts have over 250K. But what percentage does that 1% represent? That seems like the biggest question at the table right now is that 30% of the deposit holdings. Is it 10%? Because I think even like 15% would be enough to push the bank into and make them insolvent, which is where this new like line of credit that the Federal Reserve is issuing to small banks comes from. But that you're right. That's the question is what percentage of total deposits are held in accounts greater than 250K in regional banks? Because consider those are going to bounce. Those are going to go into the bigger banks.
Or as the innovation continues, how many opportunities will there to use regional and community banks to park the minimum 250 across a network of dozens and dozens of banks? So they end up serving a totally different and high value purpose, which is that they can accept deposits on a distributed network. SoFi, Betterment, you name it, have created up to $5 million in FDIC insurance. And what they're doing is just simply using a program of networked banks where your money is held. You put in $1 million and they divide it up, right? So I also would just say don't underrepresent the potential that these banks might be systemically important for different reasons as the model for how you navigate through one front door to multiple avenues of having that FDIC insurance will continue to grow. It's not a new concept, but it's very popular, again, in the treasury management space for businesses. And I think it's definitely increasing in popularity on the consumer side. So I think it's going to be interesting actually to see how those smaller banks serve a really different and important purpose in networking deposits where higher net worth, high dollar deposit accounts need the insurance protection and can't get it from a single source. Because as a human, I'm not going to go manage 20 banks, but somebody who does have $1 million that needs to stay in cash is facing a really tough problem. So I think the innovation is just going to continue.
Innovation is a positive spin word for sure. I mean, for a business, that would be definitely a point of friction, right? If you had, say, like I saw Roka had $400 million in SVB, but say a smaller company, say they had $50 million. Like if you wanted to be fully insured, there's no way a business could operate having, what is that, 4 to 100 different bank accounts.
But that's why the banks provide it for you. That's what treasury management at its finest is. That's what the bankers do. Creeps, like repos, this all exists for a reason, right? And as a founder running a company with a lot of capital, my first question was like, where do I park it? It's not insured. And you quickly find that there are products, some insured, some not, and there's going to continue to be solutions that folks look for and build that take advantage of being able to swiftly, back to my point of fast money movement, move money between banks so that you can always have it in the right spot at the right time. This is what treasury management is. And when you layer together some of the SaaS companies that have been building software and you layer together the payment services like ours, you actually have a really rich portfolio of opportunity to take advantage of trying to navigate exactly that, which is, of course, there's no one person at a company who could navigate that complexity, but it is very possible to achieve it through technology and automation. I think it's very achievable because it's already been demonstrated through the likes of Brex, Mercury, and others who are offering up to $5 million of FDIC insurance for business customers. And that will only grow.
Yeah.
Right? To do it at the scale of 50 to 100 million is harder. This is why treasury management exists. And I think it's just going to spark more innovation in what I'm going to call the like office of the CFO function, whereas previously maybe the innovation was focused on other divisions. I think we're going to see a groundswell in the next 2 years of innovation that's building out a CFO stack.
And what's the advantage there for a business? Like, why would a business benefit from having some technology layer distribute their money across 25 different bank accounts rather than just moving it all into like one Chase account, do you think?
well, does Chase want to take every customer? I think is the first question. And the answer is no. Unfortunately, no matter how big and fantastic they are, no big bank is going to take every customer. So what do you do with the folks that are unbanked, underbanked? Businesses are obviously going to struggle with that problem just as much as consumers. So my point of view is that while there are big banks that will continue to be big banks, the small banks have a room and a real role to play.
So this would be like a fringe, not maybe not fringe, but like you said, types of businesses that big banks don't want to take. So marijuana businesses, legal businesses, but that have a, what would you call it? Like a gray mark on them. Like big banks don't want to take these. And so, yeah, that makes sense. There's like a layer of businesses that are perfectly legal, porn, gun dealerships, marijuana, stuff like that, that big banks don't want, and they give it to smaller banks. Those businesses may be thriving. They may have a lot of money and they have to manage it across different accounts. That's interesting, right? I mean, that's kind of what you're getting
at. I'm not sure it's always all those edge cases, although those are definitely underserved in banking, those edge cases you described. But I think there's a variety of businesses that just don't end up having business bank access to the top five banks for any number of reasons, location, business model, you name it, preference. Again, there are a lot of people who like to walk into a bank branch in their local community. And I think that's not going to go away in the next decade. It may change how many we need, where they're located, what they do, but I don't think we're going to see a disappearance. And I certainly hope we don't see a disappearance of regional and community banks. What I do hope is that we continue to push boundaries with how the smallest banks can take advantage of the growth and innovation, like what we do at Aurum, to make sure that instant is everywhere. And it's not isolated to the top 20 banks or the top 300, that everybody has instant. If every American can pay another American instantly, then I think we're talking about the right solutions are covering all the right parts of the ecosystem.
On those instant payments, say just hypothetically, actually it doesn't even really matter if there's bank consolidation, but say there were, right? Just food for thought. Say we 10 years from now, these regional banks basically have no equity. They all get rolled up. There's like 100 banks in the country. Do you see the FedNow program becoming, how does that change the underlying rails of FedNow? If that,
well, it probably doesn't change it at all. Today, there's only a thousand banks that can actually use what's called a FedMaster account, which is the main account to hold money at the Fed. And so everybody else goes through a bigger bank.
But
even though there are 5,000 banks, there's really only 1,000 that connect directly to the Fed.
Interesting. I didn't realize that. And so they all have to, and those bank accounts, those are federal bank accounts through the Federal Reserve?
So that's the clearinghouse for them to clear and exchange funds.
So I guess green, yellow, red. Red being unhealthy, yellow is all right, maybe uncertain, green is good. How do you view the health of from a CPA or a financial planner's perspective? Like, do you feel the central bank's balance sheet where we are is like, what's the path forward? I know you don't have the answer, but I.
Well, financial planners focus on individuals. So I don't have an answer. Probably there's a crossover of, you know, healthy metrics to track. But as a CFP, I'd be much more interested in figuring out, how are you going to pay off your debt? How do you get to retirement with the best use of the dollar that you have in your pocket? And so I couldn't comment on how the central bank's finances look today.
I'm curious to ask you a little bit more about that. What's, if you were to choose a financial planner, what would you look for? What are the types of characteristics, background, attributes of a planner? On paper, many, many people look the same.
Let's start with how you get paid. Do they get paid by selling products, or do they get paid by managing assets, or do they get paid an hourly fee? That matters, because if you get paid by selling products, you're more incented to sell me something, whether I need it or not. So I look for folks who are fiduciaries, truly fiduciaries and stewards of the customer, which means that they're typically paid by the hour in what's called a fee-only model. So that's my starting point. And then I look for someone that I'm actually going to enjoy working with, because money is not a once-a-year painful conversation when you think about filing your taxes. Money is an always-on conversation, and it should align with your values. It should be something you talk about when things in your household or your lifestyle change, when the economy changes. So looking for someone where you're like, I want to call you. Or more importantly, you're going to call me when something relevant is happening that I should be thinking about. Or maybe I don't think geography necessarily matters, because today it is pretty easy to hop on a Zoom or be fluid. But for some age groups, that's less easy. And sometimes regionally, there are tax advantages or state level things that you want to plan for from an estate perspective. So there can be times when having somebody local who understands the nuances matters. And then there's the like specifics of, let's say, in the founder world, founder equity and all that goes with it. So sometimes you're looking for an area of specialty. By and large, though, I would say advice as a whole is a commodity. The math on how much to save for retirement is never going to change. How much you might need for retirement varies by individual, but the actual math is never going to change. And thus, I think what you're looking for is not somebody who can do better math. It's somebody who can make you understand and feel confident in the decisions you're going to make and actually help you make, not just follow, not just like read the financial plan, but execute it, take advantage of that knowledge and build wealth and pay off debt and build a better future. And that comes back to why at Aurum, I care so much about solving time to money. Because if it didn't take time to get paid, to earn your wages, to pay back a debt, to do everything that we've talked about, we'd be in a wholly different world with financial advice. So that was my original inspiration. It remains a big part of my inspiration. And it's why I think faster, better payments is the answer.
Do you think financial planners, do you think the industry of financial planners changes? Do you see it as being?
Oh, definitely.
How does it change? Does it go more like?
It's already changed. Well, if you think about it, it was originally kind of designed for the wealthy. So it had technology available only at a certain kind of like wealth and income level. And I think what's changed is where you access it. Again, how ubiquitous advice is. It's around every corner if you look for it. But financial planners and advisors themselves look really different. Sometimes now you will find folks that have gone through and gotten a college degree in financial planning, right? Much like a few years ago, people started getting degrees in product management or design, which was not as maybe common as it was previously. So I think it's really cool to see young people who want to spend their entire careers helping folks figure out how to manage money, do it and do it from day one. I think algorithms that drive how we think about investing and saving are big force multipliers. I think with generative AI, with like even just like the basics of ChatGPT, you can serve more customers more seamlessly. You can explain things more thoroughly and you can have base models for building financial advice that get everybody started faster. And I think at the end of the day, like I said, the math is largely the same math. It's the contextualization and really operations of making sure that you're taking advantage of the advice you're getting. So I think absolutely folks are going to change. They're going to be supercharged by technology and they're going to change the way they work, right? Fewer yellow legal pads faxed into an office or voice memo notes taken, although that definitely still exists. And probably a new portfolio of products that suit today and tomorrow's customers, right? A lot of what we still have in financial services looks a lot like it did 20, 30, 50 years ago. So back to the infrastructure and sort of age question, pushing boundaries. And I think some of that's already starting to happen in the way investing is working. Like I love platforms like public.com and Follow, which is new, where you can get information about what other people invest in so that you're not in isolation making those decisions. So I think there's a lot of really powerful social impacts that will come as well as we see how advice gets delivered and where people intersect with advice, financial services, and ultimately, hopefully a financial planner.
Yeah, super interesting. Yeah, certainly AI screams like it's going to impact it. I mean, I imagine there's a strong, I don't know what percentage, but there's a strong degree of like therapist relationship. Like I want you to tell me that I'm doing a good job and that I'm managing my money well and I'm not making a dumb mistake. And at the same time, I'd like to be really tactical and smart with the strategy. So yeah, AI seems like it would be powerful. Man, I can only see that. Because even now, like when I talk to people about like, how do you make a decision on what percentage of your portfolio to have in like the S&P versus Bitcoin versus like a savings account or something. And it's like, I don't know, this feels right. This is somebody I follow on Twitter. They have a good mental model of the world and I subscribe to it and it changes. And I suppose there's a degree of discipline that comes from having a relationship with someone that holds you accountable, which is probably a huge portion
of
it, right? Yeah.
I mean, think about fitness. You can get all the answers to every fitness question on TikTok, but are you actually fit?
Yeah, that's a good point.
Probably not. You probably need someone to hold you accountable. Yeah. So I think it translates for sure.
Totally, totally. Well, awesome. I really appreciate, Stephanie, you telling your story. It was really exciting to hear you transition from being a financial planner yourself and now running this awesome company at Aurum. So thanks again for hopping on today, and I wish you nothing but the best. Are you online personally? We'll have all the links to the company in the show notes, but are you tweeting or blogging or anything you wanted to throw out there?
I'm old school.
Fax you?
I do some slacking internally, but best way to reach us is through hello@aurum.io.
Cool.
And I would love to have a conversation, so let's talk.
Awesome. All right, Seth. Talk to you soon.
All right.